Good afternoon, friends. Today, July 20th, 1958, will be forever distinguished by the showing of the bust of the great Seminole warrior patriot, champion of his peoples, Osceola. It is fitting that our speaker comes from the state of Oklahoma, that he is a justice of the Supreme Court of his state. Most importantly, he is a Cherokee. I am happy to present the Honorable Napoleon Bonaparte Johnson, President of the National Hall of Fame for Famous American Indians, Judge Johnson.
Mr. Barnes, members of the Stephen Foster Memorial Committee, ladies and gentlemen, I bring you greetings from the state of Oklahoma on behalf of Governor Raymond Gary. I also bring you greetings from Chief William Keeler of the Cherokees, who wanted to be here today. I consider it an honor and a privilege to have this opportunity of saying a few words in this beautiful Stephen Foster Memorial Building. It certainly is a fitting and proper tribute to a great man, and the state of Florida and the Memorial Commission is to be congratulated for the fine recognition they have accorded this great man. I am in this state of Florida particularly to participate in a ceremony of the Seminole tribe. I am very happy indeed to see the many interesting things that I have seen during the 2 days I have been here. When the Europeans first came, most of the territory now covered by the southern states and where we now stand was a beautiful homeland of five powerful nations known as the five civilized tribes: the Seminoles, Cherokees, Chickasaws, Choctaws, and Creeks. These tribes lived in peace and contentment long before the advent of the white man. Their industrial development consisted mostly of home handicrafts of basketry, pottery, and weaving. Their methods of making a living varied, and their tools were primitive. They were content to live with and be one with nature. They accomplished vast adjustments of bodily and technical economy and learned to survive where most many men after them perished. Their way of life and their values, both economic and social, differed vastly from those of the Europeans who discovered them. The Indians in our nation have played a vital role in forming our American character. The sounds of Indian words like Susquehanna, Mississippi, Minnehaha, Okaloosa, and Sewanee falls as a kind of music on American ears. Our military strategists early in our history adopted Indian tactics in battlefield maneuvering. Our preoccupation with outdoor camping, our Boy and Girl Scout movements all have drawn upon and been enriched by the lore of the Indians in wood and watercraft. The contributions made by the Indians to what we often refer to as the American way of life could be adequately listed only in encyclopedic form. There are that many. Few people know the important contributions of the Indian to white civilization and white culture. He taught the white man how to cope with the wilderness of this new continent. Taught him how to hunt, fish, trap, and canoe. He gave him the great gifts of cotton, corn, tomatoes, tobacco, peanuts, beans, squash, rubber, cocaine, cocoa, and many other products. And these have today become multi-billion dollar American industries. In World Wars I and II, the American Indian made a most credible record. They contributed more in the purchase of war bonds and manpower than any other comparable group within the nation. In 1952, President Eisenhower, in a speech at Gallup, New Mexico, said, quote, never once in all the campaigns of Europe, with 3 million Americans under my command, never did I have occasion to hear a complaint about the battle conduct of the North American Indian, end quote. These powerful Indian nations were not always to live in peace and contentment on the lands which were their rightful possessions. The land-hungry white settlers were pushing to settle on their lands. President Andrew Jackson, cognizant of this fact, finally yielded to the demands of the white settlers and removed most of the 5 civilized tribes in 1838 to the territory west of the Mississippi River to what is now the state of Oklahoma. However, some 2,000 Cherokees refused to move, along with a number of the Seminole tribe, and chose to fight for their rights, but they were finally forced into the mountains and into the Everglades in resistance to the efforts of the government to remove them against their wishes to the new territory west of the Mississippi. The great leadership of Osceola in defense of the rights of the Seminole Indians is one of the remarkable events of history. It is in recognition of his ability, courage, and leadership that the state of Florida, the Friends of the Seminoles, and representatives of Oklahoma and other sections of the United States have assembled here today to pay tribute and honor to that great leader of the Seminole tribe. His statue will be placed in the Hall of Fame for Famous American Indians at Anadarko, Oklahoma, along with the statues of Chief Joseph of the Nez Perce, Alan Wright, Chief of the Choctaws, Black Beaver, and many others, including the famous Delaware Scout. In closing, may I say that the tide of civilization is coming in from all directions. The white man's way of life is here to stay. To get the most out of life, the Indian must become an integral part of that culture. The Indians of my state have come to realize this and are fast assimilating into the white culture, and they have gone hand in hand down the road of progress with the non-Indian citizens and have added immeasurably to the wealth and stability of the state of Oklahoma. We must educate our young boys and girls to become useful and self-supporting members of society. Educate them in our public schools so that they can meet the white man in a competitive world. Robert L. Owens, a Cherokee, was Oklahoma's first United States Senator and co-authored the Federal Reserve Act with Senator Carter Glass. Bill Stigler, Choctaw, Charles Carter, Chickasaw, and Bill Hastings, Cherokee, each served Oklahoma in the United States Congress for many years. 3 members of the present Supreme Court of Oklahoma are regular enrolled members of Indian tribes, and the last 2 governors of Oklahoma are of Indian blood. Many other Indians have gone far in the professions. The time is here when the American Indian should want most of all just to be an American citizen like any other citizen and enjoy the blessings and privileges of American citizenship as well as assume its corresponding obligations and responsibilities. He is fast passing out of our national life as the painted feather-crowned hero of fiction and is adding the current of his free, original American blood to the heart of this great nation. And is adding the current of his free, original American blood to the heart of this great nation. I made one or two bumps.
As director of special events at Stephen Foster Memorial, I have the pleasure to have here with me today some distinguished guests in the beautiful Carolyn Tower Auditorium. These guests include Mr. Logan Billingsley of New York, formerly of Oklahoma, who is one of the founders and guiding lights of the Hall of Fame for Famous American Indians. Alvistus came to Florida to participate in the unveiling ceremonies of the bust of Chief Osceola, which is on display here in the Memorial Tower for a few days, after which it will be shipped to Oklahoma to be placed in the Hall of Fame. Now, I would like to ask these gentlemen some questions regarding this fine organization, the American Indian Hall of Fame. Where is the Hall of Fame for Famous American Indians located, Mr. Billingsley?
The American Indian Hall of Fame is located at Anadarko, Oklahoma.
And what are the aims and purposes of the American Indian Hall of Fame?
Well, the aims and purposes in general are to correct mistakes of history as to the American Indians, and in particular to perpetuate the lives of the leaders of the various Indian tribes.
Mm-hmm. And Mr. Billingsley, it also recognizes those outstanding Indians who have made some signal contribution to our American way of life. Is that true?
That's the purpose in general.
When was the Hall of Fame organized?
It was organized at Anadarko, Oklahoma, in, I've forgotten the month, but anyhow, in the year 1952, and organized under the state laws of the state of Oklahoma. It's a non-profit membership organization, supported by contributions from its members, of which it has several hundred. It's also supported by the state of Oklahoma, and it cooperates in general with not only the state but also the Oklahoma University and the American Indian Exposition.
Who's eligible for membership?
Any American citizen is eligible for membership in the organization.
Could I be a member, Judge?
Well, there's no question but what we would be glad to take you in as a member if you want to pay the minimum fees to join, which I'm not anxious to mention because it don't amount to but $5. Some of our contributors have, I think the largest, of which there are several dozen, about $100.
Well, that's fine. I'm sure that you'll gain many more members right here in the state of Florida.
I'm Judge Johnson, president of the Hall of Fame, and if I may cut in here, it might be interesting to know that this Hall of Fame consists of a 10-acre tract of land. It's landscaped and beautified by our Planning and Resources Board, which is our park board. And it's a very beautiful location, just east of Anadarko and adjoining the city of Anadarko.
Well, I think it's wonderful to have it out of doors. It's certainly highly appropriate. How many famous Indians have already been elected to honors in the Hall of Fame?
I would say that I believe 11 have been definitely elected, and 3 have been installed in the Hall of Fame, and with Osceola, who will be installed next month, will make the 4th, and then it will be followed next year by Vice President Curtis and Will Rogers, that I remember. There is one other. Who would that be? Sequoia.
Oh, yes.
Who invented the alphabet for his tribe, for the Cherokee Indians.
Who sponsored the election of Chief Osceola to the Hall of Fame?
Chief Osceola of the Seminoles, whose bust we have here today, was sponsored by Irving Teichman, historian of the Southern Illinois University.
Good. Judge, what other organizations are cooperating in the activities?
Well, I've just mentioned the American Indian Exposition, the state of Oklahoma, and Oklahoma University.
Oh, yes.
Mr. Billingsley mentioned some of the candidates, and he covered most of them, but it might be interesting to know that we haven't overlooked the women.
Oh, good.
And Sacagawea, the famous Indian girl who led the Lewis and Clark expedition to the Pacific coast, has also been selected for a place. That's correct, isn't it, Mr. Billingsley?
That's right. That's right. Sacagawea is the way I pronounce it. And I'm not sure that I'm correct at that. But anyhow, Sacagawea and Pocahontas also. We've had letters from the governor of Virginia who nominated Pocahontas as a candidate for election.
That's fine.
And also the Historical Association of the State of Virginia. There's been several letters come in from prominent sources in Virginia urging Pocahontas, and she's well on the way on the agenda to be elected.
Mr. Billingsley, this is Judge Johnson speaking. Didn't the Hall of Fame join some historical organization? Maybe Mrs. Billingsley mentioned some organization.
Oh, yes. I think that's quite important, too. What organization was that?
The National Association for State and Local History.
Oh, the National Association for State and Local History. And our organization belongs to that.
Yes, and we're a member of that.
That gives us a national recognition and advertise our organization in a fine way.
Well, that's splendid. Now, I'd like to know who the sculptor of the bust of Osceola was.
She's quite a distinguished sculptor in New York, Miss Parks. Now, what is her first name?
Is her name Madeline?
Madeline, yes, Madeline Parks. And everybody seems to think that she did a wonderful job. She went into the in her research that covered about 7 months. She went into Washington to the what institution is that? The
Smithsonian?
Yeah, Smithsonian Institute, and dug up the death mask that had been lost for years. And with that and other material, She finished the work, and everybody feels very proud of the job that she finished.
So you really have a true likeness of Osceola in this bust.
Yes, it's bound to be because it comes direct from the death mask.
We here at Stephen Foster Memorial are tremendously impressed with the strength of the bust. And we feel highly honored that this is the only Florida showing of our native son before he goes to attain real immortality in the Hall of Fame at Anadarko.
Well, being interested in the Indian question for many years, I was interested as well as impressed to know the interest that the state of Florida is beginning to show in the Indian people of this state. I met Mr. Max Denton yesterday, who's Commissioner of Indian Affairs. They have set up that department to study the Indian question insofar as it relates to state affairs. And I think it's a wonderful thing that the state's showing that interest. I also learned that the Indians are being encouraged to attend the public schools, and that's a very progressive step. That's being done in my state, and as a result of that program being followed for many years, our Indians are fast assimilating into the general citizenship of Oklahoma. And Florida is certainly taking a progressive step in setting up this state agency to help the government solve this problem. Too often, the citizenship of the state has been inclined to look at the Indian problem as a federal problem, but it certainly is a problem for the state, because any group of people living within the state must necessarily be a concern of the state. Now, if I may say one word while I'm here, we are here at this historic site, this great memorial here. In the short time we've been here, we've seen the Suwannee River. We took a ride down the river this afternoon, and I've been told about the springs here that the Indians have in the past come here to these springs and sought medicinal aid from the waters. And it seems to me that this would be an ideal spot here at this beautiful Suwannee River and these surroundings here to set up a museum for the Indians of Florida, the Seminole Indians. This state is rich in history, and we of the present don't always appreciate these historical values that are here with us. But we must remember that when we are gone, there are other generations that will appreciate these fine historical matters. And it would be certainly be a great thing to set up an Indian museum here in this vicinity. And I hope that the state, Florida, will consider this matter.
Thank you very much, both of you, for being with us and contributing so much to this program and to further the cultures of the state of Florida.
I understand in connection with what I've just said that we appreciate being here, and I thank you very much. Now, going back to what I just said, I understand that the Indians brought their young braves here in the early day and trained them as medicine men. And that's a very fine historic event.
Yes, and that's historically true. We have here every year, the first weekend in May, a wonderful folk festival where we bring the old songs, the old tales, and the old ways of Florida. And we found from the Indians who attend our festival that fact about the medicine men.
I want to thank the Seminole Committee when we considered unveiling the statue of Osceola here in Florida. We felt that it would be a proper recognition of people who are interested in historical events to appoint a Seminole Committee. So we selected some outstanding citizens here in Florida to serve as a Osceola Unveiling Committee. Now, they've done a fine work, and they prepared an excellent program, which we had down at Dania yesterday.
We want you to know that each one of us feels deeply honored to have had a part in the unveiling ceremonies. And we hope that the committee can function in the future and be of great service to the Seminoles and to the state of Florida.
Sorry that our time is limited here in Florida, but Mr. Billingsley has to get back to New York, and I have to get back to Oklahoma. And I want to, before we go, I want to thank Mr. Barnes, the head of this commission, of this memorial. He's been most courteous to us, and he's shown us around the memorial and explain many of the things that they have here. And to anyone who has never seen this memorial, they're sure missing something. This is a fine memorial to a great man, and it is most interesting. I wish I could spend a week here to read all of these events and these documents relating to Stephen Foster. It's a great memorial, and should be the pride of the state of Florida, and I'm sure it is. And I thank you, Mr. Barnes, for the many courtesies you've shown us while here.
Gratitude to those of you who have come from other states to help us to pay this fitting tribute to Osceola. You have assisted us in catching a vision of what ought to be done and have helped us to make this vision a reality. Osceola possessed many elements of greatness that prompt us to honor him today. His unwillingness to sacrifice principle for expediency, his bold and decisive action to uphold a principle, his facing danger undismayed, and his acquiring the leadership of his chiefs by open means, and his wearing this toga of leadership on honorable terms, all are worthy of approbation and our emulation. His discipline was of the wilderness born, a discipline which he sternly exercised in the control of self, but which at times lacked sophisticated moderation in his dealings with others. As a warrior, he was deadly as a foe, stealth in revenge, daring in his executions of his policy, and capable of masterminding a desperate struggle. Great men and great deeds impress themselves upon our land in different ways. The name of Osceola has been the inspiration to the founding fathers of the villages and cities of 19 states, which have placed named communities in his honor. Florida, Michigan, and Iowa can boast of counties as well as cities named Osceola. Streets in many sections of the country, a mountain in Massachusetts, a lake in Alabama, and a United States naval ship do him silent honor in bearing his name. Osceola belongs to that rare company of men whose deeds in ages past have merited their being immortalized in epic song. His character and his deeds, recorded in both legend and factual history, are of epic proportions, to the extent that when the Epic of Florida is finally written, Osceola will take his place with other illustrious men who established themselves in our esteem, Ponce de Leon, De Soto, and Andrew Jackson, to name a few. We Americans, in choosing our heroes to honor, most often select men who, without the advantage of family position and the fortuitous assistance of wealth, achieve status alone. Such was Osceola, who, to quote from a contemporary of his, made himself, no man owed less to accident. Osceola will long be remembered as a man that with the feeblest means produced the most terrible effects. This is true greatness, and for this we honor Osceola today.
Albert, it certainly is a pleasure to have you and Jesse Bell here this week. It's been something we've dreamed of working out, and to have it a very real reality is pleasant indeed. I wonder, you have talked to people this week about Osceola, if you learned anything additional from talking to the people.
Yes, Miss Thelma, you always run into somebody that knows something, and you realize that you never learn at all. And I've enjoyed being here, talking with the people, giving them what little information I've gathered. It's been a great pleasure and a joy, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. And I hope that be able to attend further the folk festival and visit the memorial during different times of the year and coming through and seeing new people.
Mr. Devane, Mrs. Devane, we consider you about the best authority on the Indians of Florida and particularly the Seminoles. I wonder if we could ask you a few questions.
Mr. Barnes, I don't claim to be an authority. I have done some reading, and I've been associated with the Indians in the last few years, Ms. Devane and I, Jezebel, I'll say, and they're friends of ours, and they visit with us in our home, and we go down into their camps and their chickies and eat sofke and whatever they have to eat, which is all very good.
Would you tell us what sofke is?
Sofke is a gruel or a soup, I might say, made of corn, ground up. Sometimes if they got the whole corn, they put it in the old mortar and pestle and beat it up, and then it's put into a large pot of water, and it's cooked with no salt. Some of them use the ashes of the water oak tree. Only the water oak ashes are used in this in making this sofke. Now, most of them, however, use soda, and there's more of them that use coarse grits, if they can get them, which most of them do, in making their sofke. This sofke is eaten by the Indians, the children and all. It's drank hot or cold. The sofke pot is always on the table, and the children often want, instead of drinking water, why they'll come and get a dipper of sofke. It's very nutritious, as the children are all apparently healthy, and mighty fine as far as health is concerned.
I think you said that when you were coming up to the folk festival that some of the Indians brought some softy along with them in a thermos. Yeah. Now, Mrs. Devane knows about that.
Lucy Tiger brought a thermos bottle full of softy, and when we stopped to have our lunch coming up, why, she got out this thermos bottle full of softy and passed it around.
Did you have some?
Yes, I'd tried it before. I don't particularly care for it because it doesn't have any salt in it.
One thing I'd like to ask you about the Indians in Florida, maybe sort of an impossible question to answer, but could you tell us how many tribes of Indians that you know of that have inhabited Florida?
Well, the first record that we have of Indians in Florida, of course, was with the discovery, and at that time, we had the Colusas and the, which is along the, around Charlotte Harbor Bay with Carlos was the King Carlos, or Chief Carlos was the chieftain, and then up around Tampa, which is on Tampa Bay, around the old Philippi place, or about where Safety Harbor is now, where the Temucans. And, of course, on the East Coast, they had down around Miami, they had the Tequistas, and then on up around Jupiter Lighthouse, Cape
Canaveral.
Canaveral, there were the Ailses and the Jobes. Of course, the Yemeceys were up, including northern Florida, on into Georgia and South Carolina. Now, that was prior to the Seminoles coming into Florida. The Seminoles came into Florida right after the 17th century. One authority says about 1721, another one about 1750. However, most agree that it was about 1750 when the creeks, one section of the creeks, broke off from the main Creek Nation, and Secaucus and a part of a band went and settled in the Alachua area. Their town was Tuscarawas. The old town is about a half a mile from where the present city of Micanopy is. The first record that we have of this town, of which was around 1765, at which time John Bartram and his son William came into the state after Great Britain acquired it in 1763. Then his son William came back in 1774, and at which time Spaulding and Patton Leslie and Forbes had established a trading post along the St. John's River. Bartram left from Picolata, which is about 7 miles south of Palatka, and went into this town, Lachaway town of Secaucus, at Tuscarawas. He stayed there, it was 10 days, and he gave a very fine account of the Indians, their methods, their food, and the cattle, which were only savannas, no horses. And he went from there across the south and west end of Payne's Prairie, which was then he called the Alachua Savannah, across by Archer, across the hills, by to Chiefland, and to the Suwannee River to an Indian town called Tallahassee, whose chief was white. Well, I don't recall his name offhand, but anyway, he stayed there for 3 or 4 days, and they was having a little trouble with some of the Indians across the river, and he'd kind of got that quieted down and told Bartram about it, and so Bartram crossed the river, crossed the Suwannee, and went into the area of the hammock area, which, well, I don't know what it, I guess possibly it'd be the old town Suwannee area. And he spoke of the old fields, old cultivated fields, hammock fields, at that time, which was 1774. But he didn't know who were the, whether it was Spaniards or early Indians who had cleared this field. He then came back and went across to Orange Lake. There was where the wild orange is in, and across the River of Styx, which is now Cross Creek, on back by Kingsley Lake, which is Stark, and from there on back to Picolata, sailboat up the, on back into Jacksonville and Charleston.
Cal Ford.
At yes. Cal Ford, yeah. Cal Ford was identified, in other words, to later become Jacksonville. At this point, was where they swum their cattle across the mouth of the St. John's River at the bar when they were taking the cattle into Georgia, or on up into South Carolina, or moving them either way. They were swum at this point, and also they it was a means of transportation across the river for their horses also.
This little town of Lake City was called Alligator. Do you know anything about how it got the name Alligator?
No, there was a pond, a large pond in high water that had an awful lot of alligators in it. And other than that, I couldn't say. But it was called Alligator way back in the very first records of the state. Possibly the Indians named it, I don't know.
I think they're writing a history of Columbia County now, and I think they're going to bring that out in the history. What do you consider the most famous of the Indian chieftains that have been in Florida?
Well, now I expect. Well, that's kind of hard to say. Of course, we take the from the Spanish. What we get of Carlos, from whom Caloosahatchee River was named, he was a great chieftain and one of great power. He even the Indians over on the East Coast, what they call the Freshwater Indians, and the Okeechobee area, he demanded from them a certain amount of food and their crops and so on, and he was a powerful Indian. Of course, we come on down later in the period of Seacoffa was a great chieftain. And
did he have another name?
Seacoffa, the only name that I know of, it's a name that Bartram gave him. If I understand, it's S-C-A-C-O-F-E-A, Seacoffa. But they ordinarily call it Seacoffa. Now, some of the histories say that Billy Bowlegs the first and King Payne were the sons of Secaupe. That I don't know. But in most of the histories, or most of the Indian, their heritage came down through the nephew. Now, whether Billy Bowlegs the First and King Payne were the nephews of Secaupe or the sons, there is two versions. Some say he's the sons, and most histories say that they were the sons. Now, King Payne, he was a great he was a great leader. Had lots of cattle, only Savannah. And Billy Bowleg's town was over at on a Suwannee old town. That was prior to 1818, when Jackson came into St. Mark's and captured St. Mark's from the Spaniards, and then made a drive into Old Town, towards Old Town, Suwannee or Old Town. And on this trip, there was 900 Indians under General McIntosh. General McIntosh was one half Indian, but he was a brigadier general. And under him was Thomas Woodward, who was one quarter Indian, was a major. And Captain Isaacs was one of the captains. Whether there was more, I wouldn't say. But this was the expedition when they captured Osceola, who was a lad of 13, about 13, and his mother, his grandmother, and no doubt his great aunt, Betsy Durant, who was the wife of Peter McQueen. Peter McQueen, Billy Bowlegs, and most of the warriors got away. But they captured five warriors and quite a few women and children. Osceola's mother, grandmother, and possibly great aunt all interceded with Jackson to let them go since their husbands had gone. And Jackson, who 4 years previous had defeated William Weatherford at Horseshoe Bend, and thought an awful lot of Weatherford. It's very possible when Betsy Durant told Weatherford that she was the first cousin, a second cousin of William Weatherford, the great chieftain, that he might have turned her loose. There's no way, because we don't have any record. But they were related. At any rate, he let them go. And from there, they went to the Suwannee River, and from there, we think, to possibly the Okefenokee Swamp up the Suwannee River. How long they stayed there, I don't know.
He undoubtedly passed right through our area here around White Sulphur Springs.
Oh yes, no question about that, because the Suwannee River was the main source of transportation, and it's very possible that Billy Bowlegs also went into the Okefenokee, because we have a Billy's Island still known today in the Okefenokee, which no doubt was Billy Bowleg's camp. And it's very possible that Peter McQueen and all the rest of them went in there. Well, after that, then they moved. When General Clark, who was a revolutionary soldier and a soldier of the War of 1812, and was also in the Georgia militia, made the expedition against the Indians in the Okefenokee Swamp, it's very possible that they moved on south into the Tampa area, because the next time we hear of them, they are in the area of Tampa Bay. Well, there was one big camp around Tampa, which was a hammock field, which was called Hitchipocky-Sassy. That's in the vicinity of Plant City, which was a large Indian encampment. At this point, or somewhere about this point, John Durant, who was the brother of Osceola's great aunt, Betsy Durant, died. And Sandy, who was her brother, took a boat, a fishing schooner, and went from there to Providence, West Indies. How long they stayed there, but the next time we hear from them, Osceola is growing up, and the next we hear from them is in the Ocklawaha River area. They start north. That's around 1800 and 33 or 4. He's in that area. And of course, from 32 to 34. And then at the Treaty of Payne's Landing, of which he attended, but was not in the capacity of chief, but was counseling all of the other chiefs, including Micanopy, who was the head chief, against immigration. And he was the one of the most of any sub-chief against this removal. Then when General Jessup called the chiefs into Fort Dade for another talk, I believe this is a place, I'm not positive, but he in the meantime had been made a sub chief, and when they were signing, and there was about 6 or 8 of them that wouldn't sign, why Osceola came up, and he, without anything to say, but was knowing how he went, why he took his knife from the sheath, and he slammed it through the peace treaty into the table, and said that this is the way that I shall sign the treaty. Now, General Thompson doesn't, in his report of this meeting, doesn't report this, but this has been reported by some of the men who accompanied them on the trip. I will say that that in the actual peace treaty, which is signed in Washington today, there is a mark or a hole or a, it looks very much like that it was a knife thrust into the peace treaty. Some say it was a crease in the paper, but it's very possible that it was a knife. I believe you asked me, I'll say again, who was the next Indian chief of the whole, which had more prominence than anybody else. We'll have to say that of the Seminole, that Osceola, Useyahola, or Osceola, was the most celebrated war chieftain of any of the Seminole nation.
Osceola was married, wasn't he? Did he have more than one wife?
Osceola was married. He had two wives. When he was captured and put into prison at St. Augustine, why, he sent for his wives and two children, and they were brought in, and they stayed with him and was transferred with him to Fort Moultrie, South Carolina, and was with him at his death, after which all of the Indians who were imprisoned there were sent to Indian Territory or Arkansas following his death.
Is there any record of any children that they had?
Osceola?
Yes.
Oh, yes, he had two children. Whether the two children were by one wife or one of each, we do not know. In other words, I don't know. But he had two children at his death.
We don't know whether there are any descendants of Osceola today or not.
As far as I know, in Florida, there is no descendant of Osceola. The Osceolas that we have in Florida just took the name Osceola. Today, I believe there's 147 Osceolas registered at the Indian Agency, but I don't think there's any one that is any blood relation to Osceola.
Now, Albert, you just said that the Osceolas that we have just took the name. I think it's interesting to know how a Seminole gets his name.
Well, I might answer that most Seminoles, they are given two names. They're given a name at birth, and then after they become boys, anywhere from 11 to 15 years of age, I don't know exactly when, at the green corn dance usually, why they are given another name, and another Indian name. Often it is after some relative or chieftain or some man who possibly has died before them. However, this is not always the case. Then most Indians have a name they call a white man's name. A greater part of them in the early days took up the name themselves. In other words, they became attached to some man, and they took his name up. I can name of many in South Florida who were named for different people.
Frank Shore, for instance. Well, how did Frank get his name?
Frank Shore was named for a captain on Lake Okeechobee on a boat. Who Frank thought an awful lot of. He fished and hunted around the lake, and he that's who his name was taken from.
Was he named for the captain or the father?
I believe his father named him for the captain.
Yeah. Well, maybe you're right. But he was named for a captain of a boat early in Okeechobee.
And now I'm wondering how Polly Parker got her name.
Who?
Aunt Polly Parker.
Well, this is only
hearsay.
Yeah, hearsay or guesswork. Early, right after the Civil War, when the Indians began to come out deep out of the Everglades.
All right,
you asked the question how Polly Parker got her name. If my recollection is right, I could be wrong. I think her father was named Gottsaw, and her mother, or Polly, I say Polly, after the Civil War, between 1866, or about actually 1868, is when it really happened, they came out of the Everglades, deep into the Everglades, into the area north of Okeechobee, in around Fort Drum. Henry Parker, a trader who went into the area purchasing skins, alligator hides, and so forth, opened a trading post at Fort Bassinger first. Went there in 1872, I believe.
That was on the Kissimmee River.
Which was it? That was the post of General Taylor at Fort Bassinger. Then he moved into Fort Drum, which is an old military fort, and opened a store, and which was Parker's store. And Henry Parker, he took her husband, took the name Henry, and he was known as Indian Henry Parker, who was her husband. And he kept that name, a white man's name, Henry Parker, until he died. Now, she possibly had the name Polly. I don't know where she got that. We have two names of Indians which have come down, as several of them is Polly and Nancy. Nancy is another name which has been passed down. Now, it's just pure guesswork. I couldn't tell you. She might have been named for Polly Osceola's mother. I find a Sam Jones in the Creek Nation in the 1790s, and we have a Sam Jones who was the leader of the Seminoles, who lived to be 108 years old, who refused to emigrate. Was one of the ones who refused to emigrate. So they take the names from other people, as I say, older people away back. But it's just where Polly got his name. Your guess is as good as mine.
Now, are there any descendants of Polly Parker living?
Yes. Ms. Devane and I worked this up 2 years ago when we brought Polly up here, and at that time they was
Lucy.
Lucy, who was the daughter of Polly. There were 267 descendants of Lucy, who was the daughter of Polly. And
Albert, Jezebel's shaking her head. Wait a minute, let's see what she has to say here.
No, of the 300 and some odd Indians that live on the Brighton Reservation, better than 200 are descendants of Polly Parker. And there is at the present time 5 living generations of Polly Parker. She has one living daughter, her youngest daughter, who is Lucy Tiger.
And how old is Lucy?
She's around 90.
Uh-huh.
She has a daughter?
Lucy has a daughter, and her daughter is Lena Bowers.
Uh-huh.
She married
Joe Bowers,
who...
Or Motlow.
His Indian name was Motlow, but he was given the name Joe Bowers from old Uncle Joe Bowers, who had run an Indian trading post out at Indiantown.
Now, did he die? Did I think I heard you say earlier that perhaps he died and she, Lena, married again, didn't she?
Yes. He died. Joe Bowers died, the Indian Joe Bowers. And then she married Eli Morgan, who is the son of Billy Bowlegs III. And I might say right here that Eli Morgan is the last of the Deer Clan.
Chipko was of the Deer Clan, and the last two children... of the third generation from Chipko, there were only two boys and no daughters. Consequently, when George Osceola died, he was of the Deer Clan, and Eli Morgan, and they have no sister, or they have no sister. Consequently, the Deer clan dies with Eli Morgan's death.
And I think it ought to be brought out right here that the family line goes down through the girls, not the boys. And that's why when Eli dies, the Deer clan
is extinct.
Is extinct.
That's right.
Now, I'm going to ask this question or I'll forget. I want to know how you happen to know the story of the Evangeline of the Everglades.
Well, we learned that from, we call Polly Parker the Evangeline of the Seminoles. And we heard this story from her daughter, Lucy Tiger, by her great-granddaughter, Geneva Shore, acting as the interpreter.
Uh-huh. How'd she happen to tell it? Did she volunteer to tell it?
Yes, she did. We were just talking about the old Seminoles, see, in the old times down there, and she was got to telling Geneva about it, and Geneva then interpreted it and told it to us.
Yes. Geneva is a high school girl, is she not?
Yes, she's an honor student at the Okeechobee High School.
Uh-huh, belongs to the Beta Club.
That's right.
Now, we've talked about Billy Bowlegs the first, and we've talked about Billy Bowlegs the third. And what happened to Billy Bowlegs the second?
Well, Albert can tell you about that.
Well, Billy Bowlegs the second was and Micanopy were brothers. Or, well, I'm sure. I think that's right. I think they were brothers. They both had in 1822. Billy Bowlegs, he had moved his town down about 8 miles. I believe it was southwest, if my recollection is right, from Micanopy, and Micanopy's town was at Micanopy. That was Billy Bowlegs the second. Billy Bowlegs the first, of course, died, who his brother was King Payne. And then in 1842, when General Worth made the treaty with the Indians, terminating the war, giving them the area south of Peace Creek across to Vistapoke, Kissimmee River, on across Lake Okeechobee to the Shark River. They moved into that territory, and of course, Billy Bowlegs did. Of course, we know the history of that when they the surveyors went down there and tore up Billy Bowlegs' banana patch. They said they wanted to see Billy Bowlegs' lab and see what he would do. Well, they found out what he would do, because the next night, was when they really had the trouble. But they finally, General Harney, finally made a peace with Billy Bowlegs, and he, after much money, I don't know how much, they say $100,000, which is possibly right, he and 134 of his people, mostly women and children, left Fort Myers for Arkansas on May the 5th, 1858.
Wait a minute, Albert.
Okay, go ahead. What was you doing?
Well, you said after the money, but you didn't say it changed hands.
Well, the money did change hands. In other words, he was given the money because after he got to New Orleans, why, the Picayune, the paper there, said that Billy was had money. Well, I believe they mentioned they knew he had $50,000 and didn't know how much more. That was the New Orleans Picayune, I believe, in an editorial at that time. And, of course, he went on to Arkansas, and the balance of them was left there. Now, that's Billy Bowleg the second. Now, Billy Bowleg's the third. Billy Bowleg's the third was the... he tells me that he is a grandnephew of Billy Bowleg's the second. Now, Billy's father was Billy Fuel. Billy Fuel was also known as Key West Billy. His father built the first frame house among the Indians at what is now known as Devil's Garden. He had a Tupelo on kind of place on the top. He built him a set of stairway up the side, and he'd get up in this place and shoot deer from this place. That's what they told.
So where is Devil's Garden?
Devil's Garden is near the present Cypress Reservation. It is.
Is it south, near a town?
Southeast of Immokalee, I would say. It's a very rough country. And Billy Fuel took his name, I might say, from Billy Fuel or William Fuel, who in 1870. Was a purchasing agent for the Spanish government of Cuba in buying cattle, which was loaded in boats at Punta Raza and shipped to
Cuba.
There's where he got his name from, William Fuel. Of course, he helped old Cuba. F-E-W-E-L-L, Fuel. Billy Fuel was of the Wynn clan. The Wynn clan is the police clan of the Indians. They are the more or less, we consider them the highest clan. In other words, they make arrests and can inflict punishment for different things when no other clan can seek revenge or anything, only maybe a very short time, week or 10 days after the things done. I mean, after any committed any crime or anything else.
Is there any particular clan that the chieftains are selected from?
Well, only in a general way. The chieftains and some of the early Creeks were selected, many of them from the Snake clans was a clan who chieftains were selected from, and the Wind clan. Both the clans were considered very high clans.
Well, some,
but it didn't necessarily mean that they had to come from that clan.
Actually, some the chieftains are not selected from certain clans.
Oh, yes, that's very true. We have in the Seminoles today at Brighton, I know more about the Brighton than I do about the Cypress, but in the Brighton we have the wildcat and the deer and the bird and the little bird. The otter and a snake. That's in the Brighton clan. I think maybe so there might be one or two more clans. I understand that there's still one or two alligator in the Cypress, but I do not know them or know who they are.
Now, how many chiefs are numbered amongst your clans there at Brighton?
How many chiefs?
Yes.
Well, since about 1890, this is only quoting Minnie Moore Wilton, whose book the Seminoles, wrote the book the Seminoles. They have not had an overall chieftain since about that time. They have their medicine men. At Brighton, we have the Wildcat Clan is the are the medicine men of the Creeks, or the Brighton Indians. I say Creeks; they're called Cow Creeks because they speak the Creek language. They're all Seminoles. Of course, Seminoles is a combination of several of both the Miccosukees, the Creeks, and possibly the Spanish Indians. Now, the Spanish Indians, I don't know what they spoke, very possibly the, I suppose it was Miccosukee, but I wouldn't know.
Albert, Jezebel says that they referred to themselves as Seminoles, that they don't actually maybe like to be called Creeks.
Well, I wouldn't know about that. I know in talking to them why they refer to themselves as Seminoles.
Uh-huh. I think that's very interesting.
And,
I want to jump back and ask you a question now before I forget it about Billy. I think he's such an interesting, fine old man.
You mean Billy Bowlegs the Third?
Yes, Billy Bowlegs the Third. Have you any idea how many deer he's killed in his lifetime?
Well, I don't know why during his early life why what money he made was from killing deer, and he sold the deer hides. And the largest part of the money was from deer hides.
Mm-hmm.
Now, later on, of course, they got the hunting orders around Okeechobee and alligators. But I can only say that Billy told me about one week's hunt when he went into what was then Buck Island, which is now the ranch of Durnt, and he had bought him an ox, and he trained this ox to lead, and he put his little paraphernalia on this ox and led him into this sawgrass marsh, and he spent a week in there, and he killed 38 deer. He killed 9 the first day, and he skinned them all out, and then carried them back out where he was camping at that time, not more than 5 miles from where he lives today. That was before there was any reservation or any thoughts of the government taking over this land. That was their old hunting ground where the reservation is today. Well, then when the government came in there, but they had moved out, and most of them were living along the Kissimmee River and in the Fort Drum, Fort Pierce area. But they always came back to this area for the green corn dance. And after the government bought this and established this thing, they never had another green corn dance on this land because it was government land, I suppose. I don't know. But anyway, they moved.
Probably contaminated by the white man.
That's right. And they moved their place for the green corn dance 40 miles from there, and they've held it out way in the woods since then. And they've never held another green corn dance on the reservation.
Where was Billy Bowlegs the Third born?
Billy Bowlegs the Third was born about 2 miles from the on the Arbuckle Creek, where it runs into Lake Istipogee. In a point of timber that they were camped They were there on a bear hunt. It was in the fall, and the bear at that time were eating low bush acorns and huckleberry, I mean, and palmetto berries. So that's where he was born.
And Billy told me the last time we visited with him in his camp that he was born 1864, which I think is very interesting because that's the year Stephen Foster died.
Yes. Well, I don't think there's any question about Billy's age being right. Because I've checked to the other events of where he was at. In other words, when the first train came into Kissimmee, and when the train got to West Palm Beach, and riding over the first road from Juneau, what was it? Juneau, Mars, and the Celestial Railroad on the East Coast. He was on the first trip of that train, was there when the boat was unloaded, the engine from, he gives very detailed information of staying around there until the train got in operation. And I don't think there's any question about Billy Bowlegs is 95 years of age.
Billy reads and writes.
Oh yes, Billy reads and writes. In other words, he was more or less the ambassador to the Indians in the early days who couldn't read and write. And he took the Sears Roebuck and Montgomery Ward catalogs and placed orders for them.
I've heard you tell it before, but I'd like to hear it again about the escape of Polly Parker at St. Mark's and another with the others of the Seminoles.
Ask that question again, Mr. Barn.
The escape of Polly Parker at St. Mark's with other. The Seminole.
Well, I'll start back and give you a start with the history a little earlier. Polly Parker, they were camped on Istipogee, on Lake Istipogee in that area. And during this period, when the government was giving from $100 for children to $500 for warriors, bonus for their capture to be sent west, Polly Parker and her father and I don't know how many more were captured. They were carried by ox wagon to Fort Brooke, Tampa, and then put aboard a boat and carried to Egmont Key. They was there for, I don't know, 2 or 3 months, until Billy Bowlegs and his people went to Arkansas. Well, they stopped and picked them up. And their only thoughts was to escape. Well, while they was aboard ship, the boat that they was on was a steamer, and it was fired by wood. And they had to stop and get wood. The one stop they made was at St. Mark's. And they asked permission to get off and gather some medicine, that some of them was sick. Well, the officer in charge granted the permission, and 12 of them were allowed to go ashore with two guards. And they went up the St. Mark's River, and they were all looking along the side of the river, gathering their herbs for medicine, and at a given signal prearranged by them, they scattered into the swamp like rabbits. They run, and of course the guard had fired off the guns. Whether he killed any of them, I don't know. But anyway, 6 of them escaped. 6 of them got away. They never caught them. And they traveled by night. They stayed in that water with the heads submerged, the bodies submerged, and eased along by night, and And the fourth day, they hadn't had anything to eat, only eaten a few berries. And the fourth day, why, they speared some fish with a sharpened stick and built them a little fire and roasted these fish, the first they'd had to eat. And then they made their way by night and scouted by day, and they made their way clear on back into the north end of Okeechobee and to their old camps. And nobody there, of course, everybody had eaten the Everglades, but they found an old pot or something, and they cooked them a little something to eat. What it was, I don't know, but they worked their way clear on back into the Everglades. And the story of Polly Parker. And it is a true story.
Albert, was Polly married? Wonder how old she was.
Oh, she was said to have been about 110 or 12 years old.
When she died.
Uh-huh. But she was a young married woman at the time.
I don't guess they'll answer that.
Lucy Tiger, her daughter, told us that she was, and they had not captured her husband. And that was one reason that she was so desperate to escape from the boat. And she walked all the way from St. Mark's, Florida, back into the Everglades.
How far is that about?
Well, 500 or 600 miles.
I would say it's at least 400, between 450 and 500 miles.
I wonder how long it took them.
I don't remember asking Lucy that question.
Ask her sometime. I think it would be very interesting to know.
I have an idea. They were several weeks or 2-3 weeks or more because they hid out by day and walked by night. I might tell you that Lucy said her mother became ill on this walk back, and she begged the others to leave her because she was afraid that they would be captured if she was along. She was detaining them by being ill, but they would hide her and come back and get her that night.
We mentioned, I think you mentioned before, some of the descendants of Polly Parker, and you mentioned Lena Bowers. Now, Lena has a daughter too, doesn't she?
Lena has two daughters and five sons. And her daughter Lottie, is married to Frank Shore, one of the medicine men. Frank's brother, Oscar Hall, is also a medicine man, as is
Charlie Mickle, Sam Jones.
Sam Jones. And then he also has a brother, Charlie Mickle. Lena's other daughter's name's Mildred.
And she lives
Then there's five sons.
And she lives, is she still living?
Yeah. Tell her who Mildred married, Sam Tommy.
Mildred is married to Sam Tommy, preacher. A preacher. And then the boys are Andrew Bowers and Dick and Tom and Casey. And I can't think of the other one's name right now.
Now, Frank Shore has some children too, doesn't he?
Yeah, Frank and Lottie have seven children, four boys and three girls. Four girls and three boys.
One boy and a half.
All of his children attend the white school in Okeechobee.
Now, the oldest one is
Geneva
Shore.
The oldest one is Geneva.
And the next to her?
The next one is Eddie. And then there's Brown, and the youngest boy is Jim.
About the little girls?
Well, the younger girls are Nancy, Mary Jane, and Molly. And I might say, and speaking of where they got their names, I know the family of white people that the younger girls were named for. Nancy and Mary Jane and Molly were all named for Morris and Mary Jane Crumb's family.